Hello, Market Watcher. I'm David Ravel, and this is the Sunday edition of Value Side. It's our preview of the week ahead. Q2, the best of times. Well, this coming week will be dominated by our look back at the second quarter of the year, which, by almost all estimates, may be the best quarter of this year. We begin the week with the start of earnings season, that time when all the publicly traded corporations report to their shareholders, just how well they performed over the last quarter. And we begin, as is the tradition, with the big four banks, JPMorgan Chase, the nation's largest bank, Citigroup, the Bank of America, and the troubled Wells Fargo. For these four banks, and indeed for all the companies reporting, this should be halcyon times. Not only was it a good quarter, but it compares to that absolutely dismal second quarter of 2020, the quarter when the economic lockdown really gained momentum. So the comparables should be outstanding. You'll no doubt see lots of CEOs wanting to brag about these results. In midweek, Jerome Powell, chairman of the Federal Reserve, will go up to Capitol Hill to present his twice-yearly testimony to Congress. And like those CEOs, I'm sure that Powell will make lots of the progress made in the economy, especially in that second quarter. And he'll now have the data to back him up. So this is the week that will seem like everything's coming up roses. That is until you adjust your focus to the future. It's then that things don't look quite so rosy. Nearly every analyst on Wall Street now see the second quarter as the pinnacle, with the rest of the year performing 30-40% lower than Q2. This is especially the case for the Fed's two models of the economy, the Nowcast, run by the New York branch of the Federal Reserve, and GDP Now, run by the Atlanta branch. Both of these, combined with the Fed's own long-term models, point to an economy that's slowing for the rest of the year. So tilt those champagne glasses now. This may be the best we see for a while. Up next, this week's market comments. Well, have you heard about what's happening in the land down under? They're going through one of the most stringent economic lockdowns ever. You see, while we're enjoying the best of summertime up here in these states, it's just the opposite for the Aussies. They're in the middle of their winter, the time when respiratory diseases, colds, flu, and the dreaded Delta variety of the COVID virus strike the hardest. And while the infection rate in Australia seems ridiculously tiny by American standards, none of the provinces has more than 1,000 infected to date. Nonetheless, the powers that be, the politicians and state leaders throughout the country, are acting on an overabundance of caution, quote-unquote, as they say up here, restricting travel, reinstituting the mask wearing, and encouraging, perhaps forcing, the citizens to get the vaccine, take the jab. It's really a remarkable overreaction by administrators who by now should be used to handling this health crisis. As I've noted on this podcast before, the real measure of the impact of the COVID virus ought to be the number of deaths. And by that measure, certainly Australia is one of the most fortunate nations on the planet, with fewer than 1,000 deaths recorded since the pandemic began. And it's hard to understand the motivation for these political leaders in their headlong rush to a lockdown. After all, these restrictions, as we've found out, are not entirely benign. They're fraught with costs that go well beyond the mere economic. Although let's not forget the economic cost, as here in America we suffered through the greatest drop in our economy ever, and we are still suffering with the continued interruption of the supply chain. But beyond the dollars and cents, many lived with the mental anguish of interrupted jobs, loss of income, disruption in normal daily routines. The results were measured in depression, anxiety, drug and alcohol abuse, sometimes breakups, and even suicides, all of which showed marked increases during the American lockdown. Now, none of this has gone unnoticed by the global economists and their macro models. which are now calling for the Australian stock market to lose about 10% over the coming year. You see, there is a cost to these lockdowns, and although that cost can be measured partially in monetary terms, the bigger cost is that borne by everyday people in our countries who must put up with real hardships. The loss of a business, the loss of a job, or the loss of a relationship can be devastating. I think that's why we're seeing the beginning of a backlash up here in the States. Although they're late into the game, my own state of Pennsylvania has just passed a law severely curtailing the ability of the governor to institute just the sort of lockdown that you're now going into in Australia. In addition, several lawsuits are working their way through the courts as small businesses are looking to recoup some of the losses impounded by those businesses when they were closed by that selfsame governor. So here we are today. America is enjoying summer, while Australia is feeling the cold blast of a new winter. For one country, the beginning of a free and open economy. For the other, a new lockdown. Well, historically, this is the time of the year that people get out and travel, the time when most people have their vacation, and traditionally, when they load up the car and hit the road. Now, the pandemic changed all that last year, when the hop in the car, drive 100 miles, was shut down by various state quarantine policies. Who wants to drive for hours to see grandma, only to be told that you must first self-quarantine at the local hotel? Many of those restrictions have been lifted now, but another constraint has hit those of us who are road warriors. And that constraint is the cost of gasoline itself. Now, I confess I don't pay too much attention to the price of gasoline until it really starts to affect the old wallet, like it does right now. My car has a standard 12-gallon gas tank and takes regular gasoline. Last year, it cost me about $26 to fill up the tank. This year, it's costing $37 to fill up the tank, and that price seems to be rising constantly. Currently, the price of gasoline is 95 cents higher than just 12 months ago. And I'm sure you've noticed this too. And it has a real impact on our collective spending. Assuming that you fill up your tank about once a week, about average for me, then that's a $40 reduction in my discretionary spending for the month. Really, a kind of subtle, hidden tax, if you will. Unfortunately, this hidden tax appears bound to rise even more. Last night, the Energy Information Agency reported that U.S. crude inventories fell another 6 million barrels in the week ended June 25, and now stands fully 3.5% below where they were back in 2019, the last year before the pandemic. In fact, this dramatic climb in the price of gasoline, combined with the climb in the price of new and used cars, accounted for fully one-third of that rise in inflation that everyone is talking about. Take the car out of the equation, and we would see little inflation at all in the economy right now. But there is another, more fundamental reason that we're seeing a climb in the price of gas, and that's the change in Washington. Over the last two presidential elections, the nation went through one of the most vivid policy reversals we've ever seen. For the Obama administration, the goal was to move away from carbon-based fuels like gasoline and move toward renewable energy. Oil and gas leases were few and far between, and fracking in particular was frowned upon. Now, that all reversed under President Trump, when oil and gas production was welcome. The businessman Trump recognized the vital role that gas plays in the economy, and for the first time in memory, the country became a petroleum-exporting nation. Then last November, the nation reversed itself again, back to the Obama policies of gas bad, renewables good. And we're back to mid-$3 a gallon gasoline, just like we were from 2011 to 2014 during the heart of the Obama administration. Now, for many, this may seem like a small price to pay for the transition to solar, wind, and hydro energy. And without getting into all of that debate, Let me just point out that today's issue is how to climb out of this economic hole we're in, a hole that was created by last year's economic lockdowns. And taking another $40 out of my paycheck each month is not a positive way to grow this economy. Higher gas prices inevitably lead to a slowing economy, something we really don't need right now. Wow. Perspective. It's the single most important thing in guiding your life, your business, and especially our country. You must possess the ability to look beyond the day-to-day, momentary nits and gnats, and visualize where you'll be years down the road, when your child goes to college, when you retire, or some future event. It's the first thing that any financial planner will talk about. Any good planner will spend time helping you create the path that may take years to unfold. A financial plan is built on your ability to project, and it will put you in a position to prosper no matter what your circumstances might be. Now, yesterday we had the most recent release of the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee's latest minutes. They were the minutes of the meeting held on June 16, and like any good financial professionals, the FOMC began their discussion with an assessment of where we are as a nation and where we are likely headed. First came their estimate of our economic growth for this year, then next, and the year after, and finally the longer term. But the Fed never got to talk about next year or the year after. If you were to listen to Wall Street and especially the financial press, you would swear that the only thing discussed was if and when interest rates would be tightened. Now, granted, if you're a short-term trader, and that seems to include about 80 or 90% of the street nowadays, this is important news to know. Everyone from high-frequency day traders to hedge funds wants to know just when to set their next position based on the short-term interest rate. Fine, I understand that. Myopic as it may be, it's a fact of life that much of our finances are managed in this way. But to me, this was far from the most important message that the Fed was trying to convey. The big news from the Fed was the headline, and it was missed by almost everyone. So as I noted, the Fed at the very beginning laid out just what they saw as our economic future. And looking at the top line, the overall growth rate of the overall economy, as measured by the gross domestic product, it does not look good. Here then is their projection. This year in 2021 will be just fine. Growth rate will be above trend, probably about 7% or so, due in large measure to the multiple stimulus packages. Our momentum continues next year in 2022 with a growth rate right on line with the economic long-term trend. That's about a 3.3% rate, according to the Fed, in GDP next year. So basically, we're getting two positive years of economic growth due primarily to those stimulus packages. And just what is stimulus, you might ask? Well, basically, all of these programs are merely debt. We're living right now on Uncle Sam's credit card. And that's okay. Sometimes even entire countries need to dip into their reserves. But as anyone who has ever had to live off credit cards for a month or two knows, you really, really don't want to overdo it. Because all the debt you borrow today has to be paid back tomorrow. And that can be a really painful experience. And that's just what the Fed is seeing in our future. Sure, 2021 and 2022 are going to be just fine. We've got plenty left on that credit card. By 2023, we'll continue to go on, but just on fumes. The momentum built this year and next. However, look out come 2024 and beyond, and things start to look a little different. Just 3 short years from now, from 2024 and beyond, for as far as the Fed can see, we're going to be burdened with low growth. The price we pay, literally, in interest payments to that ballooning national debt, our credit card that we're spending right now. growth will come in, by the Fed's projection, only about 1.8%. That's about a third lower than what should be our historic economic trend, because new businesses and financial innovation will be crowded out by an unreal debt service that we'll be burdened with from 2024 on. So if you're wondering why some in Washington are beginning to get cold feet on the administration's latest round of stimulus, this is why. Or if it's a puzzle to you why the bond market has suddenly risen from its slumber, this is why also. Bonds become one of the best investment in such a low growth environment. And this was the real message that the central bank was trying to deliver. We have a future of lower than normal growth because of higher than normal interest payments on our debt. It's too bad that so few could visualize this. Well, for anyone interested in the future of global finance, this is your weekend. Beginning in a couple of hours will be the Cyber Polygon, organized under the auspices of the World Economic Forum and its founder, Klaus Schwab. This weekend's meeting will bring together the world's economic movers and shakers. And for those who may think that these types of confabs are merely academic exercises, I point you to Event 201. Held back in October of 2019 and jointly sponsored by the World Economic Forum, Johns Hopkins University, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Event 201 was focused on the then seemingly remote possibility that the world might fall victim to a global pandemic. Just 18 months later, that's exactly what occurred as the COVID-19 novel coronavirus struck nations around the world. It was Event 201 which gave the structural pre-planning to the crisis, and from which the political leaders constructed their responses, following the early Chinese examples of wearing face masks, social distancing, and the various types of quarantines, from self-quarantine to actual physical quarantine. Now, we find much the same pre-planning for a potential crisis in today's cyber polygon. Only the topic today is the various emergencies that would be created through a shutdown of the internet. Specific areas of concern that they will address today include how to combat ransomware, how to make supply chains more resilient, and how in general to make financial systems and especially digital currencies more resilient. And by resilient, they mean primarily the ability to survive a massive cyber attack. This, of course, implies that the World Economic Forum sees various and yet unnamed rogue players in the world who present a direct threat to the functioning of the global financial system. Now, it's interesting to speculate on just who those rogue players might be, but I have not been able to find any specific reference in their agenda. Perhaps that will be discussed later today. Now, if you were to take one thing away from today's Cyber Polygon meeting, it is that these world leaders see a definite and immediate threat to the world's online systems. That the threat of complete internet takedown is a distinct possibility. And their job today will be to set some of the groundwork for such an eventuality. Notice that as they lay out the structure of this response, it has a distinctly global and a distinctly European bent. Now, the chief law enforcement agency to pursue those rogue actors would be Interpol, the multinational European police agency. And the Red Cross is raised up to the level of chief agency to provide humanitarian aid caused by any failure in the internet. Then, two brand new global agencies are suggested, one to regulate the World Wide Web itself, and one to curtail internet bullying of children. Overall, today's Cyber Polygon meeting provides the framework of a massive enhancement of the control and regulation of the internet, all by agencies that would be created should a massive online outage occur, an eventuality that clearly the World Economic Forum, at least, feels is right around the corner. We'll have to wait and see if they're as prescient in predicting this cyber crisis as they were in predicting the pandemic. And that's Value Side for Sunday, July 11th. I'm David Revell. Please join me in praying that our country may get back to work. Thank you.